Welcome to Late Night Poetry Jam on KKRN Community Radio. I am Pamela Spoto, poet and host.
In my heart, in my brain, on my tongue, behind my teeth. Behind my eyes, on my tongue, under my skin, in my heart. In my veins, under my skin, behind my teeth, on my tongue, on my tongue.
We are broadcasting from KKRN Community Radio in Round Mountain. We will host a monthly poetry show the very last Saturday of the month at 10 p.m. So here we go. Well, Late Night Poetry Jam tonight is going to be a little bit different because I don't have a particular invited guest. But what I do have is Doug Bennett in the studio, and he is the producer and engineer for Late Night Poetry Jam. And he also has his own show on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. called Unspun. So what I had decided is that Doug and I would read poetry. We do our own little poetry jam tonight and talk about poetry. So I think that will be fun. So I'd like to say a few words about Doug Bennett because he is my dear friend too. And as I mentioned, he's a radio show host. He's a local activist, and he's been working on social justice issues for as long as I've known Doug, which has been, what, over 10 years?
Yeah, closer to a dozen, I think.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we're something happened.
Yes.
Time went by.
I was going to say something happened. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that too.
Time went by. And in fact, I think we met each other doing some social justice activities. And as a matter of fact, that was Citizens for Responsible Government that was started here in Reading. And Doug was the chair of Citizens for Responsible Government. He's also a former board member from the ACLU. And he's a poet.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, it's interesting when we try to put, like doing that intro, you're trying to describe or define somebody, right?
Yes,
but part
yes.
of what poetry is about, in my mind, is getting past that. So how do we get past that? We're using words to try to get past words. And that's what so challenging, I think, to try to get to a deeper meaning or maybe a deeper truth.
I think that's true. And when I talk to students about what is poetry, that comes up because it is really hard to define. And it always comes back to, for the students anyway, and for me too, is that there is an emotional, emotive aspect to poetry, besides being most of the time rather succinct versus other kinds of writing. But it's beyond words, I think, and that's a really good way to say that. We use words to get beyond words to tap into the heart, maybe, into the feelings, and then this whole notion of truth-telling. I think the world should be run by poets.
I would vote for a really good poet. We haven't got one of those running, do we? We don't have a poet.
No,
running.
We don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. It's about truth telling, but it's a degree more because words simply are only words. So, how you put them together and how you make them work against the feelings to maybe resonate with somebody, that to me, that's what poetry is about. How do you get there from here? So, and usually my poetry is, I'll either wake up in the middle of the night with a really good idea or feeling or something important like that that I want to communicate, and then I go from there. But or I'm inspired by something like other friends reading poetry that inspire me to comment somehow back in the same way to try to get to that same emotion to go beyond the words.
Yes, yes. And I, as you were saying that, not that I wasn't listening to you, I was very much listening to you, but I was also thinking about a poem that I wrote, which is really true in terms of wanting to create that feeling and how the words look to me on the page and how the letters kind of bump into each other. And it's and then I read it out loud, and I'm listening to the rhythm and the flow. It's really kind of a combination of different kinds of ways of putting words together. So you're right; it does go beyond words in that way.
And I think the roots the roots of poetry have got to be music and rhythm and dance, because that was first. Before there was language, there were, all of those things existed. And relationships and emotions, all of those things existed long before words, let alone written words. So it's all that past and all that emotion and all that, whatever that was before words, we still have access to that. And so how do you write those words down to access that and to resonate with somebody else?
And maybe that's why it's, as you were saying that, I was thinking about the words in the air. You know, there's a difference between reading the poetry quietly to yourself on the page versus speaking it, poeting it, and the way the words move in space. Yes, I'm hoping has impact on the audience, on a person's heart, because it changes. I mean, when those words come alive, I talk about words dancing off the page when they become alive and they move.
and that comes right back to the fact that words are just words, and the printed word is so much less effective, because we are social creatures. We talk, we touch, we think, we feel. It's not a, you just don't, you know, a really good writer and understands that and tries to paint a picture that gets you to react. So, and I think that's true of poetry.
And I think that's also why it's difficult, and I don't want to separate this is music, these are lyrics, this is poetry, this is prose, because all of that can come together in a mixture to produce this impactful resonance.
Mm-hmm. So, and maybe we can do a little of the sampling, because
okay.
I'm a great fan of the mystic poets, and I consider myself a mystic.
And you are. I forgot to say that. Doug,
well,
the mystic.
That should be taken for granted. I but I have there's kind of a chronology to some of my poems. My older poems, unfortunately, they disappeared into the ether of time and space, and they're not here. But a lot of my older poetry was written around the relationships between men and women, not only romantic, but what's happening. There's more, always more happening than that. It's not just sex. It's not just, there's something else always happening in a relationship. Probably the reason we have them. And some of my earlier stuff was about that. But this is more of a mystic, this poem I wrote, it must be 10 years ago now, when I realized how some people just hold on to their beliefs so tightly, they're not able to do. I mean, they're bound. They bound themselves up with their own beliefs.
That's an interesting image, and there's an image, and often poetry does have that in it, that belief can hold you, can confine you, can imprison you. I like that.
So I'll read this one.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go right ahead.
All right. This is my first poem on the air as a poet. it's called Hold On. Life, a fragile bubble at best, a thick film of beliefs held too tightly. And like the child's balloon, it dissipates into its own beginnings, having bumped into the hard edges of truth.
Oh.
So watch out, that truth can be dangerous stuff.
and once again, that's another aspect of poetry. It can be another aspect of poetry, that imagery. And so, I mean, you have that balloon and the children's balloon bumping in the edges, and I like it. Are you going to read us another one?
I could do that, or we could maybe, if you had one, we could share. Or I could go to a different place chronologically.
Well, I think what I'd like to say is it reminded me when you talked about, not that you're fascinated with that, but you talked about men and women and male-female relations or relationships, however that manifests. Mm-hmm. And I was categorizing, see, there I go. I was categorizing my poetry, and they basically fall into three areas: love, the environment, and politics. And so I have done a lot of love poems, and because that whole relationship, the relationship intrigues me, and it was elusive to me for a very long time, but I did a lot of writing about that. And so I will read some love poems to it at some point.
Okay.
Or I could read one now.
Or? Well, if you want to read one now, that's fine. And I have some love poems to share, too.
Okay.
And but you read yours first. I had my turn.
Well, I have some newer love poems, but these when I pull out some of my old work, I have mixed emotions about it. And sometimes I go, wow, I really wrote that, or that's really good, or my goodness, what were you thinking? And this hasn't been published, but I have a table of contents here, and I have like a chapbook length book. And the four categories, and this is about relationship. The first category is called Teeth I'd Like to Lick. And I have about
that's
10,
an image.
And I have about 10 poems in that okay. section. And the next section is Rope and Pitchfork.
Uh-oh.
And then the third section is, oh, this Loving the Dead.
And well,
this is kind of the beginning, the pre-relationship, the relationship, the ending of the relationship,
oh,
gone bad, right?
I see.
And then at the very end is Come Here, Fear.
Ooh.
And
are we embracing that then
yes,
at that point?
Yes, because it's like, come here, fear, be my lover. Because sometimes we push these things away. And I was trying to figure out, how am I going to deal with fear? Really, how am I going to deal with fear? Do I push it away? Do I hide from it? Or do I make it my lover and embrace it? So I don't know. So I will read...
Why don't you read one from the beginning
okay.
section there, kind of like at the start of the relationships, because I have one that would kind of, correlate with that.
Okay. So here is one. And we cook dinner for each other, right? So this is a poem about that, sort of, kind of. You spread thick white rice over seaweed. The rice sticks to your fingers. Ginger, mushrooms, red chard, shrimp, peppers lie on white. You roll the seaweed over on itself, sharpen the knife and slice. You serve sushi and I cry. It was so beautiful, I had to cry.
I know. and interesting, because we often confuse food with love and sex. And, people will... make up for one with the other sometimes.
There is that, and there's also, I think, in the beginning of relationships that the other, whatever the other person doing is so fascinating and mystifying and beautiful. And I was watching this person, spreading the thick rice and making sushi, and I was just, oh, isn't that gorgeous?
Well, I have one that's okay. kind of that same beginning of the relationship thing,
uh-huh.
when you're just so completely in love,
mm-hmm.
where you just...
You just
are.
You just are,
you
yeah.
know, and
okay.
sometimes you get lost there. So this is one I call They're Out. And I want to explain a little bit before that, because I came out of a really kind of a stifling, sad relationship where the love had gone out of it.
Ooh.
And then I came into a new relationship, and I was like, I had forgotten that feeling. So this is what that's about. They're out. I thought it was simple. I thought I didn't need much. Then I opened my heart. Beautiful, fine plumed birds flew out. They soar and swoop in arcs that grace the sky. Such beauty fills their wings. They'll never willingly get back in that cage.
That is beautiful. I love that image of out of, the heart and coming from a place where it was closed or it didn't have that kind of emotion or emotional feeling to it just opening or breaking open and these colorful, beautiful birds fly out. That's gorgeous.
Yeah, and they're not getting back in that cage. Because they hadn't had that, it was, because like our hearts, they were bound up. So my heart was bound up, but then this other person freed me from that.
Yes. See, and love can do that.
Well, where do we go next? Maybe you should do a show ID.
Oh, I can do that. This is, I'm Pamela Spoto, host of Late Night Poetry Jam, and I'm in the studio with producer and engineer Doug Bennett, who also has his own show, and this is KKRN 88.5 on your radio dial.
Yeah, and we're doing poetry.
Yes, we are. Would you like to, well, we have a choice here. Would you like to do this poem together, this gabbing with Gandhi?
Oh, well, we can do. We had that one that I had so long ago published. I hadn't published it, but, and we should give Peter and Nadia Ava Robbins credit for publishing this anthology of local poets, because this was back in 2004, when right after I had met Pamela, and we were both writing very political poetry.
Yes.
And people with few morals and any sense of compassion or understanding, like George Bush and Dick Cheney, were on the rampage murdering people all around the Middle East. And so we took some of those poems, and like I say, Peter and Nadia, I think maybe with somebody else's help, but I think they're the Traveling Bohemians,
right, right,
who are great friends and peace activists, and so they put together some of our poems.
They did, and while you're talking about that, what is that chapbook called, Voice of the People, wanting to give the people voice? And I happen to have a CD as well that they made along with the same theme a couple of years later, calling Weapons of Music and Poesy. And so the Traveling Bohemians have done remarkable creative work in this area.
Yeah, and I think, and they still do.
Yes,
I think they have the Bohemian Loft.
They do.
In Redding, California, if you ever get a chance to go by there. And they do all kinds of neat things there in different productions. But I wanted to give them credit, and I know Pamela did too.
Yes.
But I wrote a poem for that, which was in the background of the poem is I had to think of a way, because I was so outraged by the lies and that got us into Iraq, which has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths, and you see what's going on in the Middle East right now. Millions of immigrants spread all over the area there now going into Europe, and all because of some greedy people that had wonderful plans to enrich their power and to take more from the people of the Middle East, and that just outraged me so. And I had read a little story about a village in India, and the people of the village were afraid to go out at night because there was a tiger that would attack these people. And the only person that seemed to be immune was a young girl about 7 or 8 years old.
Oh.
So you got me tearing up now. I won't be able to read. But this poem kind of came out of those ideas and that thought that you'll pay if, you know, the evil in people, that there should maybe be righteous retribution. So the name of the poem is I Am the Tiger.
Mm.
I am the tiger. I come in the night with a great roar. I come for the heartless and selfish, to tear their flesh from their soulless bones, to scatter their mortality as dry leaves. I am the tiger. I come fearless in righteous retribution. I come cloaked in the armor of empathy to lessen the suffering of the innocent, to speak for the silenced. I am the tiger. I come boldly, immune to darkness. I come gladly as a servant of truth, to spring upon the arrogant and deceitful, to avenge the meek and the loving. I am the tiger.
I love that poem. I really do. It's very strong, very powerful. And it speaks, I mean, it does, you know, what you said really touches my heart too, when I, because of the endless wars and all the suffering. And I was listening to a show, the best of Unspun. And I think your guest said 5,000 children a month were dying in Iraq, you know, totaling 500,000 children. And this had to do with the embargo and the blockade, the embargo
and the sanctions.
And I don't know whether people get that. And it's so what do we do with that? How do we hold that? And I think that's where the poems, sometimes poetry, comes from. It's once again speaking that truth, trying to have other people impacted by that, because it's such a sad time. It was sad when you have more than sad. I mean, I don't have the words for that. Tragic. And now it's endless. We still have all of these deaths going on and all of these refugees. And when I'm standing in my kitchen fixing dinner and it's cool, you know, the air conditioner is on. I look out at the back and we have a beautiful organic garden in the back. And I think about the refugees. It's so difficult.
Mm. And the fact that it's all built on lies, like David Swanson says, war is a lie. So all of this is lies.
And and what else can we do at this point except write about it? And I happen to have, I wrote a lot at the same time that you did in terms with the Traveling Bohemians and did performances about the war. But this I wrote in the last just couple of years because it's about this very thing. Can I read it?
Please.
And it's called The Now Clean War.
Oh.
The war has become sanitized.
Oh, so much better now.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to read it. Okay. The Now Clean War. She is tilling her garden. He's driving to the oncologist's office. He's sitting in a cafe drinking hot Sumatra. She's wearing long white silk down the aisle. A button is pushed 5,000 miles away. Grandmother in her potato patch, digging, blown to bits, an arm, leg bone, pieces of scalp, blown to bits, drones, winning the hearts and minds, hearts blown to bits, fear, day and night fear, will the drone find me, mistake me, PTSD, the people, the children, PTSD. We kill, we torture, we kidnap. Our economy thrives on the war machine, on the killing machine, on the propaganda machine. Thrives. Capitalism thrives. We say we want peace, but we love war. We love violence. Look at the movies, the music, the toys, the guns, the prisons. We love violence. So tell the truth. Stop saying we want peace and democracy when we really want power and war. The drone war, it's so good for business.
That's
creepy.
That's an indictment.
I know.
It's an indictment, but it's all very true, yeah. That's a pretty powerful poem. Was that one of your newer ones?
This is one of my newer ones, yes.
Yeah.
I move back and forth between that and other things that catch my attention in terms of new pieces.
Yeah, I have a struggle as a peace activist. A lot of people think peace activists are pacifists, but I'm not.
Oh, you're not?
No, I'm willing to fight and die for the right cause. I haven't found that cause yet, unless it would be to stop war. And so that's and that's kind of related to my little Gandhiji poem, which is kind of a two-part thing. And do you want to go there now?
Sure. And I need to tell the audience, though, that this is the first time I've seen this. And I'm going to be reading, we're going to do this collaboratively, yeah. And I'm going to be reading the words that I've seen for the first time. So I'll try my best to do it justice.
Okay. All right. I'll give them a little explanation why that's true.
Okay.
And there are words maybe you won't understand, but I'm sure most of you know who Mahatma Gandhi was. The great Indian leader that basically for 40 years through nonviolence managed to make the British Empire leave his country. And an interesting story in itself. But so some of the words I use are from the Hindi language, like Gandhi Ji is like an honorific variation from Gandhi's name. Mm-hmm. And then also I use the word Bhopu, which I understood to mean like little father. The people that were close to him and other people in India looked up to him as the father, but he was a little guy. And that's another whole story. Great read if you want to read Gandhi's life. So with this poem, I call it Gabbing with Gandhi G. And because of my my internal struggle with pacifism, but I'm a peace activist, and I want the war to end because I know that they're a lie, and I know that they're horrific, and I know that they're only going to bring more horrific and more, you know, violence to the world. I know this, and so, but I have this thing inside of me. I want to go chew the arm off of Dick Cheney and spit it out, and at the same time, I want violence to end on the basis on the level of continuing violence against Muslims.
And how much money did he make on the war? It's just an incredible amount. Halliburton and the subsidiaries.
Yeah, he's still making money. Yeah,
it's we're talking millions. It could be billions that he made.
Many millions.
I think it's $39 million.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and to think that in war the profiteering. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And while they're in office, right? So yes. this is. Me, the neophyte, I'm going to play the neophyte. Pamela gets to play Gandhiji.
Oh, goody.
And so it kind of reads like a script. So this is a neophyte, which means kind of like a newbie that doesn't know anything about nonviolence, imaginatively talking with Gandhi. So this happens in a timeless region of my mind. And Well, let me read you the first line here. In a timeless region of my mind, a neophyte and Mahatma Gandhi trade comments. I can only speak for the neophyte. Gandhi's words are his own. Pamela will read those.
Yes, I will be very spiritual.
So, Mohandas, they say you didn't like the British yoke. You didn't think the benevolent British Empire had the right idea.
Men, in their selfishness that blinds their reason, may think to score by injustice and oppression. Peoples are associated for their mutual advantage, and so, between East and West, the interaction must eventually operate to the benefit of both.
Well, yeah, sure. You stand around like dumb cattle for years while they beat and imprison you, misuse your people, and rob your nation's wealth. They have no need to cooperate for their benefit.
The British cannot rule us by force. They want India's billions, and they want India's manpower for their imperialistic greed. If we refuse to supply them with men and money, we will achieve our goal.
The same could be said when people are oppressed anywhere by any government, even their own.
Civil disobedience becomes a sacred duty when the state has become lawless or, which is the same thing, corrupt, and a citizen who barters with such a state shares its corruption or lawlessness. In my humble opinion, rejection is as much an ideal as the acceptance of a thing. It is as necessary to reject untruth as it is to accept truth.
You think the average person has the guts and tenacity to stand up to the most powerful and corrupt governments in the world? Most people don't have what it takes. Most people don't have what it takes to complain about small injustices or vocally criticize their governments. They're pretty much worthless.
You must not lose faith in humanity. Humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not become dirty.
Yes, Bopu, of course, you're right.
And I'm smiling.
Yes. You can't see that on the radio, but she's fine.
So I thought I would tell you.
Yeah.
When did you write this, Doug?
I think we had there was a poetry reading, and you were there, and you were invited, the Unitarian Church invited a bunch of us to read our poetry.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote this for that event because, conflict going. So I thought that was the best way to put the conflict. And the words, of course, Gandhi's words are actual quotes from Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
So I started from that skeleton.
I see.
See?
So all of his words are truly what he said.
Those are real quotes from Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah. Well, that even makes it more interesting.
And when I use the term Mohandas, that's actually his real first name.
Mm-hmm.
Mahatma means great soul. So that was a name given to him after he became such a leading activist and voice for the Indian people.
You know, on one level, he makes it sound so simple, and I mean, obviously, I know it's not that simple. But the notion of rejecting and accepting—you reject that which you do not want to participate in, that is doing evil, that is doing harm, that is oppressing—and you accept that which is good and is for the benefit of humanity. Do you think we could do that today? We just reject GMOs. We reject war. We reject businesses that hurt us.
I think it's the only option left because our government has been bought up by corporations. We don't really have a representative government. So I think it really direct action, refusing to cooperate. That's what how Gandhi kind of described it. Mm-hmm. It's called non-cooperation. Mm-hmm. So just because these are choices that corporations give us or our government give us that are not acceptable, we don't have to pick from those choices. We can do something different. And that's the power of nonviolence, non-cooperation.
And I think Gandhi particularly had so many people behind him. I'm wondering what it will take in the U.S. to get people more aware, because people get so trapped in those binds that you were talking about, in school, in work, in raising kids, that they don't take a civil action or action for society, or maybe they're just not informed to just say, no, I'm not stepping a foot in Walmart. No, I'm not buying processed food. No, you know, but I am going to do these healthy things, these good things. But that awareness has to be lifted.
Yeah, and part of the breakdown of the system is, of course, the system has made so many of us dependent. And because now we're poorer, growing up in the 60s, I had more, and I was poor, and I had more than a lot of people have today. So we're poorer as a nation. We have less power because they've taken our rights away. We live under fear because they intimidate us and make us fearful. But we can reject all of that. We can make better choices, and we need to. And I think you're going to see more of that in the coming next few years because of the necessity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When things, you know, it's not sustainable. It cannot go on.
It cannot go on. Mm-hmm. And since we have kind of this theme going, I think I'd like to read The Last Samurai, and then maybe we could move into something more spiritual, if you like. But let me remind the audience that this is KKRN 88.5, and I'm Pamela Spoto, host of Late Night Poetry Jam, and Doug Bennett and I are in the studio talking and reading poetry and thinking philosophically about the state of the world.
Yeah, we could do that. I have a couple of more pretty sexy
before we get
love,
to the spiritual.
Love stuff.
But it could be spiritual.
Well
I have I have some sexy love stuff too.
Okay, well why don't you read a sexy love
poem? So
poem
you don't want to hear the political devastating poem first.
Well, I think we're all over halfway through the show, so we need to
we need to move along then.
Well, maybe so.
Okay, but I really want to read The Last Samurai. So then,
do that one.
Okay, and then we'll switch gears.
And I got my little response to some of your poems that you actually did before. So.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So I don't know whether people have seen the movie. Have you seen the movie The Last Samurai?
I have.
Do you like that movie?
I do very much.
I've watched that. I don't know. I don't normally watch movies over and over. And when I'm feeling really bad, I watch that movie. Why would I do that? I mean, it's death in the end.
I know. It's
but it's so focused. It's so beautiful. I love their gardens and the principled nature. But maybe it was just a movie and it was all Hollywood. But
well, we love a hero. or a heroine.
Okay. The Last Samurai. What a movie. My favorite movie. Riding straight into a Gatling gun. Dead, of course. Well, except for the white guy, Tom Cruise, lives on. White privilege, even then. But what is it really I like about this movie? It's just a movie, my man says. Well, not to me. To me, it's focus, dedication, spirituality, being really, really, really good at what you do through daily practice. I like the discipline. It's just a movie, my man says. But I want that dedication, that focus, that strength, that skill. And the U.S., the world, is running headlong into a Gatling gun. It will sure enough kill us. Kill us all. Each bullet climate change, war, drought, lies, Monsanto, poison, greed, racism, violence. Here we are, riding straight into the Gatling gun. Wish I were a samurai, fist raised, sword poised as I face death. No fear here.
Well.
There you go.
It's mythology. But we all have our mythology.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even the goofy people have their mythology. And maybe that's where the difference between maybe a poet like yourself and I don't know, pick a congressman. Anyway, but we live under different mythologies.
I think we do. And of course, how we see the world. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And when you see money and profit and greed and wanting, you see it differently than when I look at the trees and the animals, the wolves, whatever, and see the beauty and the species, and we need all of this in the web of life. Okay, I'm going to stop talking about that.
Well, you know, I can't beat that one, so I'm going to just pass on my other political one. But my other political one really wasn't political anyway.
Which one was that?
That was the one about forgiveness.
Oh, I like that poem.
Yeah. Well, it kind of went along with the poem Melinda Brown. Was
yes.
it Melinda Brown?
Mm-hmm.
And she
mm-hmm.
talked about forgiveness. And it was a powerful thing. And at the same time, we had the voices like Pamela and others that were there at the Pilgrim Church that evening. And I went home, I remember the original outrage from Melinda and Tian and from you, Pamela. And I was thinking about that, but I was in a very peaceful state outside, and I realized the juxtaposition of the beauty of your outrage. And so I had to write something.
Mm-hmm.
So this okay. is what I this is okay. what I wrote after that. I sit in the garden, visiting sweet thoughts of dear friends. Slow and peaceful, I smile at their outrage. In the garden, delicate insects and blooms set to yield fruit in harmony. My brother, the tiger, is not to be seen. The garden doesn't bear his scent, not his territory. Maybe a walk in the jungle is in order. So that was kind of after 12 years of all of us fighting for peace and for a better government and more honesty in government and better representation in government and in the media. So that's where I ended up.
And that's a beautiful poem. That's a beautiful poem. And it is kind of that dichotomy of questioning. I mean, my reading of that and, you know, being in the garden and it's so beautiful, but what about this other? What about the other? You know, and maybe I should be doing this other.
And the interesting thing is, of all of us have moved, we've evolved through this horrific period of unbound imperialist aggression by America, and we've all been through this, and we're thinking of forgiveness. But me, I'm thinking, where's the tiger?
And, you know, I said we were going to move to our sexy poems, but I have this poem called Forgiveness, and I'm going to read that, and then we'll go to our sexy poems.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. And there is one word in here that's, you'll just see. Well, it's called Forgiveness. I told my partner yesterday, I have no poems to take to poetry group. He said, what are you thinking about these days? I said, how to forgive assholes. As I drive to work, I wonder, what will I learn today? Will I learn how to forgive one person? My stepfather? Not a chance. I told a woman, a healer, last week, I can't forgive Bush and Cheney. She said, you don't even know Bush and Cheney. I thought, what an odd reply. I see the harm, the destruction, the deaths they have left behind. How many Iraqis dead now? 1 million? I'm supposed to let them off the hook? Just let it go? No, they need to be in prison. Forgiveness has eluded me for a long time. Bad boyfriends, what do I do with them? Who will I forgive today? My mother? Or will I just blow up Monsanto and shoot down a drone? So, and I think that goes along with, forgiveness. And I truly believe that I need to cultivate that, because for me, but there is that, like, a being in the garden and the beauty of the garden, but at the same time thinking, oh my goodness, maybe I should just do this other thing.
Yeah, and it's tough because I think our basic natures are loving as individual people that we are, and knowing you so many years, being friends, we're basically loving people, but we see real evil, and the definition of evil being to knowingly harm others. Mm-hmm. And so we see this continuing evil that our country has become because of people like Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl and the neocons and all these other jackasses that have been empowered by a war machine, by money. Mm-hmm. And we see the money corrupting every part of our life, and war corrupting the morals of our people every day. And so we're outraged. And yet at the same time, we're trying to maintain some sort of loving relationship with the world. It's a difficult place to be.
And that's kind of what I just wanted to ask you. I think I'm not the only person, and you're not the only person that must have this contradiction inside, that I am a woman of peace. I believe in peace. I don't want to see harm and destruction in the world. And at the same time, how do we deal with such evil? And I'm not going to blow up Monsanto, just for the record. but
empty,
you know,
threats.
And it just, you know, just it, but it runs through my head, you know, okay, yes, I'm going to live a loving life. But at the same time, how do I stop this other thing that's happening that's doing such harm? So I think that most of us do have these different dimensions and contradictions, the shadow, if we're able to face that.
Yeah,
I think, but
yeah, we have that, and that's another concept I want to get into with you. But the shadow, and I don't know if people know what the shadow is, but here's my definition: each of us has a part of ourselves that has either been repressed while we were growing up, or repressed by ourselves later on because we can't deal with certain emotions or we can't deal with certain aspects of ourselves, so they get shoved to the back of this little balloon bubble of beliefs and that we have about ourselves. But that you can't do that because the shadow is very powerful. And most people, when they psychologically, when they lose it, or when they are just taken over by their emotions, or these negative thoughts or other thoughts that they can't control, that's the shadow acting out. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, repression is not good because that leads to all kinds of problems in your life, depression and neuroses and everything else. But there are parts of the shadow that are good, because some good has been repressed.
That's right.
In men, we're not allowed to show emotion, right? So it gets repressed, and that's not healthy because it just gets bottled up in there and it causes us problems. So I wrote a couple of poems. Actually, I had a dream. I'd been thinking about the shadow a lot, and my shadow, what that would be. And the other part about the shadow that people probably should understand is that your shadow is the opposite of what you are. So maybe if you're a black man, your shadow might actually be a white blonde woman in your psychologically, not necessarily in real life, but possibly in real life. Might be the reason we see those combinations. Or the other way around, if you're a light-skinned, light-haired, blue-eyed man, you might have a dark-haired, dark-eyed woman might be your shadow, because there's this animus quality to that. And if you don't know those terms, those are basically different terms for your shadow, but it's your shadow is the opposite sex of what you are, because growing up, you've been given a sexual identity. You've been taught what that means. And it's a very powerful part of your psyche and powerful part of who you are. So I was thinking about these things, and I had this dream. And in the dream, a dark lady comes to me. So I actually tried to put this down. There were no words in the dream. No words. It's just images and sensualities and very kind of an erotic dream, actually. So I have like two versions here. So I'll read them back to back. I call the first one Dark Lady One. She comes to me in that world between worlds. She beckons but does not insist. There are no words, only acceptance and understanding. In an effortless embrace, we are fitted so closely, there is no she or I.
Ooh.
So yes. That's erotic, but it's also kind of psychological, philosophical almost.
It is both. And I mean, in the ending of that could be, I mean, it has many possibilities of becoming one, whatever that means.
Or integrating ourselves.
Yes. And embracing that part.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like you were talking before about embracing the fear. Well, that fear is part of you.
Yes.
So if you're going to get integrated, you got to understand that part of yourself. So here's Dark Lady 2.
Oh.
She knows all of me. She approaches, sure of my need. The strength of her yielding allows a union unknown on earth. No words, effortless bliss. We become the reunited puzzle pieces.
Oh. So how did you do that? I mean, did you think about the dream from two different ways, or did you decide, I mean, because you have the two poems, poem one and two, or do you see them a continuum, or are they?
Well, I was trying to, because it was a dream, it was a very powerful dream, and I knew it had deeper meaning, but there were no words to the dream. Mm-hmm. So it was the basic problem of poetry. Mm-hmm. How do you express that? So I was looking for different ways not to only express the symbol and the images of the dream, but to somehow put that all together, which was what the dream was about. It was putting it together and being together with yourself in a such an intimate and powerful way. Mm-hmm. So I was just trying to find different ways to say that.
Yes. I really like the line of the strength in yielding, or the strength of yielding.
Mm. This is a power that women have. They, a lot of women don't understand they have that power because it's part of their nature and part of all our nature too as men, because sometimes to resist is not possible, but and not necessary. We think because of how we identify that resistance is necessary, but a lot of times there's power in non-resistance. Mm-hmm. There's power in yielding.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of explodes that whole victim, hero, bad guy scenario once you realize, well, wait a minute. Maybe there really is no bad guy. Maybe there is no evil woman. Maybe it's just me, and maybe I should let that go. Just yield to that and see where that goes.
I really like the notion of that there is no bad guy.
We're all
connected.
And so often we create our own reality psychologically by making bad assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
We assume what a person is. Sometimes we look at somebody and we go, oh, yeah, he's an adult from the backwoods. You know, he doesn't know anything. And that person will turn around and surprise you.
Mm-hmm. I was talking about this very thing today, I think, but I was thinking about Martin Buber and how we approach each other, you know, the I and the thou. And I mean, that's certainly how I approach you, the I and the thou. And when we start moving into the us and them, you know, here I am and there are those people that are the bad ones, or that could be part of myself as well. There's that. Oh, my goodness, I can't go there, rather than embracing the whole ourselves in our entirety. Yes. And, you know, because Doug and I are both on the air and Doug is the engineer, I'm kind of curious too, and I'll just ask him how much time we have left, because I need to keep track of that, and I'm not exactly sure because we've been enjoying ourselves here.
We've got about 10 minutes and we could do another show ID if you'd like to do that.
Okay.
Part of my job is
to remind me.
Yeah.
I'm Pamela Spoto, poet and host of Late Night Poetry Jam. And this is KKRN, your community radio at 88.5. And I'm in the studio with Doug Bennett. And we are talking and reading and philosophizing and enjoying ourselves. And I'm having a good time.
Yeah.
And now we're going to move into some different kinds of poetry. We've done our politics and our anti-war or pro-peace. I don't exactly know. Just life, pro-life, you know, in the sense of living things should be left to live.
Yeah.
Be they trees, water, wolves, people, whatever.
And of course, that's a huge question behind everything right now.
What is?
The allowing things to live, respect for life, true respect for
true
life.
True respect, not just, right. Okay, this can live, but no, let's kill this over here.
Let's let that child be born, we'll raise him up 18 years and we'll throw him out in the war zone and destroy him in more ways possible. So
I think those old white men in Congress should stay out of women's wombs. But okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's not. They don't know anything about that place anyway.
Okay.
So I'm assuming we're talking about moving on to like more mystical, philosophical poetry.
Oh, I was going to read my sexy poem, but we.
Let's do the sexy because I have one more sexy one.
Okay.
Dedicated to my sweet partner that. I love so much.
Oh, well, Doug, that's a wonderful thing to say. Well, this is my truck poem. It's called Sunday. I think it's a sexy poem. I'm not exactly sure.
I'll let you know.
Okay, you let me know. I like riding in your truck, the way it moves when you shift. And seatbelt free, I like sitting next to you really close, looking at your face. How your lashes touch. From the dash, Sunday passion hangs on chains. In the back, the rope and pitchfork tangle.
Whoa. Yeah, that one's, that reminds me of an old girlfriend that used to sit real close in college. Yeah. I understand that one. So, well, here's my, and this is one that I wrote for my sweet and generous partner. I won't say her name on the air because it would probably embarrass her. But.
Can I say it start? What letter it starts with?
Yeah.
M.
Uh-oh. now everybody knows. Anyway, I call this Homing Pigeon Hands.
Oh.
They flew such great distances to get home. Now, as I glide slowly over your landscape, the sparsely populated mounds and sleek appendages splayed out, they are reluctant to land. They glide and swoop playfully in the joy of flight and sweetness of caress. Then at last, they dive gently into the moisture of your downy softness, home again.
I'm sitting here wide-eyed. That's I'm telling the audience what I'm doing here. Wow, that is a sexy poem. I like it.
That was.
I don't think I've heard you read anything like that before.
Well, no, that's usually for the bedroom.
Oh,
or just for me privately.
Yes, and that's good too. There's always that discussion about in terms of poetry, what is public, what is for the public, and what is for the private. And if you know a poet, you should expect that you will be public. So there is that line about what we publish, what we read, and so forth. So that is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, eroticism is part of our being.
It certainly.
There's no doubting that. I mean, even though. Our little pilgrim ancestors were kind of repressed, but.
Well, I think maybe I'll read a couple of more here then. They're very short, very short. okay. I get giddy around you, flushed, a champagne brain. My thoughts just stop. When I try to speak, there's nothing there. I go comatose, leaning right into the door jamb. You wonder what's wrong. Guess you don't know what love looks like. And this is hot eyes, Indian nose, teeth I'd like to lick. You paint tomatoes, bell peppers, summer squash over white rice like you paint the sun red and moon yellow. It's Saturday, and I'm still stunned by you.
Oh, those are goodies.
And then one more, and then we'll move to some of yours. Cupid took a big, delicious bite out of me. I swooned and swooned, but never fell exactly. I caught myself and moved, mouth-watering, after you.
Well, those are pretty sexy, all right?
Okay.
Pretty sexy. Well, I had, moving on to...
something else.
Other topics. Well, yes, you know, yes, there's so much. I consider myself a mystic. Some people would wonder why I don't go to a regular church, but I think all of us have a direct relationship with God, and I've had some of those direct relationship with God experiences, which gives me a different perspective. And there's been, well, of course, thousands of mystics over the ages, and a lot of them have been very influential, not only on their own religions, but to people around the world. So I always keep a couple of the mystic poems with me.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Can I read some of those?
I think you should,
all right.
By all means. We've
got a few minutes left.
And I think that, I think you should go right ahead.
Okay, this one, well, one is kind of damning, and the other one is kind of not damning. I'll read the damning one first. This is by Meister Eckhart. He's a 13th century poet, and not only that, a German leader of the church. But he wrote this. It's called An Insidious Idol. Commerce is supported by keeping the individual at odds with himself and others, by making us want more than we need, and offering credit to buy what refined senses do not want. The masses become shackled. I see how their eyes weep and are desperate. Of course, they feel desperate for something, for some remedy that a poor soul then feels needs to be bought. I find nothing more offensive than a God who could condemn human instincts in us that time and all its wonders have made perfect. I find nothing more destructive to the well-being of life than to support a God that makes you feel unworthy and in debt to it. I imagine erecting churches to such strange gods will assure endless wars that commerce loves. A God that could frighten is not a God, but an insidious idol and weapon in the hands of the insane. A God who talks of sin is worshipped by the infirm. Sound like any civilization we know.
And I don't know, because I don't think we really talked about this directly. I don't know how you feel about the Pope, and I am not Catholic, but there's something that's very, you know, when I listen to this poem and I think about, if I just listen to what he's saying, I'm really moved. I mean, it's like, who am I to judge? Forgiveness, take care of the poor, take care of the world and the climate and nature. And it's and you don't have to go to church to be spiritual. I mean, it's very beautiful in that way. Whether, you know, all of those sentiments I can warmly respond to.
Yeah, and
versus
and,
prostituting
yeah,
God.
I'm not Catholic, but the Pope is, and Jesus was a Jew. These are facts, right?
Yes,
These are things we know.
Yes.
So, the Pope is trying to do some good things. I don't know how successful he is, but or will be, but we hope, and we have to respect that.
Yes. So. Okay.
All right. I have one more.
Oh, good.
I think we have time for that, and then anything you want to do to end the show, and we'll be there.
Okay.
This is a one by Rumi, which, if you don't know who Rumi is, quickly, Rumi was a 13th century Persian poet, actually, and at that time, Persia covered basically all of the Middle East as we know it today. So not only from Turkey to Iran or India, that whole area of the Middle East was the Persian Empire. And he is in Iran today, besides the Quran, Rumi's books are the next best-selling books in all of Iran. So it shows you what the Iranian people are maybe made of, a little more than we think, probably.
So, oh, that's beautiful.
So let me read Out Beyond Ideas of Wrongdoing and Rightdoing, which has been kind of a thing that has always held me together over the years. And here it is. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense.
That is so beautiful. I really like that.
Yeah, that one always brings me back to that center spot I need to be in when dealing with people, because if you start this, I'm right, you're wrong, you're lost, the arguments and the discussion's over. Mm-hmm. But that puts your heart in the right place to continue the discussion and maybe find whatever places. We all have common ground. We're all human. There must be.
And in a way, I'd kind of like to end with that poem. I mean, I could read. I have 50 poems in front of me,
but I really
like the feeling and the tenor of that poem, and it's very beautiful. So I think I just want to tell the audience, thank you for listening. And I'm in the studio, Pamela Spoto, with Doug Bennett. And we decided to do our own show this evening. And I hope you enjoyed it. And this is KKRN.org. And you can listen to the show on the computer or you at your convenience, because the show will be archived. Or you can just tune in and listen to it.
Late Night Poetry Jam.
That's right.
With Pamela Spoto.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Pamela.